All right, thanks. Thanks, Maite, for letting me speak. And yes, I wanted to tell you about a subject which is a bit important for quantum gravity and also many other topics, and this is TQFTs. And so the joke is that sometimes if you look in a book or a paper or lecture notes, it just says that a TQFT is a symmetric monoidal functor. So this is LOL. It's a totally obscure thing. And so yeah, just the letter. So it means that it's a topological quantum field theory. So it means that it's first and foremost a field theory. And then so topological, it means that it has some nice properties already at the classical level. And then quantum, because usually it means that when you quantize these theories, there are also other nice properties which appear. So this is just what I wanted to explain. And so the first thing is to give some field theory examples. Of what is a TQFT. And so the simplest example, which is very nice, is so again, it's a field theory, and it exists in any dimension. And to construct this, you basically need two ingredients. The first one is a gauge connection, so a gauge field. So you need a connection, one form. This is A. And you can also take a D minus two form, and you call this B. And then if you have a connection and a D minus 2 form, B, then out of this, what you can construct is an action, which is the trace of B wedge, the curvature of A. So this is an action which is written only in terms of differential forms. There is no metric involved. So this is a theory which is background independent and diffeomorphism invariant. And it just involves this gauge connection through its curvature and this D minus 2 form. So this exists in any dimension D. And so the nice property of this theory is that if we look at the equations of motion, so the equation of motion imposed by B is that F is equal to 0. So the connection is flat. This means that A is flat. And the other equation of motion, if you vary the connection A, you will get that the covariant derivative of B is equal to 0. You will get that dB is equal to 0. You can actually show that dB equals 0. This actually implies that B itself, you can write it as the covariant derivative of some one-form phi. But now the nice property is that it turns out that flat connections, they are actually all equivalent up to gauge transformations. And you can also show that this thing, if you write the field B as the total covariant derivative of some object phi, this is also a gauge transformation of this theory. So this means actually that for this theory, so this thing is called BF theory. In BF theory, looking at the equation of motions tells you that all the solutions to the equations of motion, locally, they all look the same up to gauge transformation. This means that if you choose one solution to the equations of motion and you choose another solution, I can always find a gauge transformation which sends your solution to your solution. This means that at least locally, the theory is almost trivial. So this is why the theory is topological. Now, another way to see that this is topological, if you are given an action and you want to check whether this field theory has this property. So these are field theories which are topological because locally all the solutions look the same. Another way to check this is to look at the phase space formulation of this theory. So what you can do is from this you can now write this wedge product in terms of components, then decompose the manifold into spatial slices and a time direction. And then after all these steps, you will find the Hamiltonian form. You will find that there are some components of B conjugate to some components of A. And essentially, for this theory, you will find that there are two constraints. One constraint is corresponding to this, and one constraint is some spatial component of this. And then if you count the degrees of freedom at the level of the phase space, you will get that the number of degrees of freedom is actually zero. So the fact that this theory has zero phase space degrees of freedom is, again, a translation of the fact that this theory is a topological field theory. Okay, what I wanted to say next is that So now this BF theory exists in any dimension, but there is a special case which is very interesting, especially for this class. It's when D is equal to 3. So in three space-time dimensions, BF theory is just three-dimensional gravity. And the fact that this is topological is the statement that three-dimensional gravity is topological. So this means that in three-dimensional gravity, there are no local excitations, so there are no gravitational waves, there are no gravitons, there are no local degrees of freedom. So for D equals 3, this is just gravity. And probably you also know that gravity for D equals 3, you can also rewrite it in terms of another theory, which is also topological, and this is Trans-Siemens theory. So you can also write another action, which is this one. You have this trace. Now you only need a gauge field A. So you have A wedge to curvature minus 1/6 A wedge A. This is also, in fact, the most famous example of a topological theory. This is defined in three dimensions, and it's BF theory. The only subtlety is that this trace here, I put trace tilde because it's not exactly the same trace as over there. So if you want exactly to map three-dimensional gravity to Trans-Siemens theory, you have to be extra careful about which gauge field you have to choose. So this trace is not exactly the same. So I said that the topological nature of these theories, of BF theory in three dimensions and Trans-Siemens theory, means that 3D gravity is topological. So this means that locally, all the solutions to 3D gravity, they all look the same. They are either Minkowski space, if there is no cosmological constant, or the Zither space, if lambda is positive, or anti-de Zither space. But this does not mean that the theory is completely trivial. There are still lots of non-trivialities. And so the first non-trivial thing about these theories is that even though in topological field theories, all the solutions are locally the same, the solutions can differ globally. And this happens in three dimensions. You can have global properties. And for examples, you have in three dimensions, if the cosmological constant is negative, you can have a spacetime with kind of funny topological properties such that the spacetime is actually a black hole. So you have black holes in three dimensions or a lambda negative. And the other non-triviality about these topological field theories is that if you define them on manifolds with boundaries, it's a kind of general feature that even if the theory in the bulk has no degrees of freedom, there can be some emergent degrees of freedom living on the boundaries, and possibly infinitely many of them. And this you also have encountered because in one particular case, in 3D gravity, this is an example of the ADS-CFT correspondence. You can have something which has no degrees of freedom in the bulk, but on one dimension, manifold of one lower dimension, you can have a conformal field theory with infinitely many degrees of freedom. So you can have boundaries with degrees of freedom. And so now, just to finish, so now these were just classical examples of field theories which have this property of being topological in the sense that they have no local degrees of freedom. So surely, if a classical theory is a field theory and has no local degrees of freedom, it means that in the quantum theory, for sure, we can expect this theory to have some nice properties, right? And so to find the nice properties that these theories can have at the quantum level, so if you want to talk about the quantum theory, well, there's two things we can do. So the first thing we can do is just consider these theories as usual field theories and go ahead and try to quantize them. So either do canonical quantization or try to give a meaning to the path integral. We can just quantize these theories. But actually, this is not as easy as it sounds, because we saw in the first example that the fact that, for example, BF theory is topological essentially means that there are so many gauge symmetries in these theories that if you take any two apparently different solutions, there is always a gauge transformation which maps the two solutions onto one another. So because there are so many gauge symmetries, It means that if you want to properly quantize these theories, there is a lot of gauge fixing to do. And usually gauge fixing is a complicated procedure. So the more gauge fixing you have to do, the more complicated this becomes. So this is actually not an easy task, in spite of the fact that these theories have no local degrees of freedom. But in cases where you can actually do this explicitly, if you are able to give a proper meaning to the path integral, gauge fix properly all this big amount of gauge freedom, what you can show is a nice property, is that essentially the path integral of these topological theories over a manifold of any dimension d, this computes an invariant or a topological invariant of the manifold. So if you compute the path integral, this actually gives you just essentially a complex number. And this number is only sensitive to the topology of the manifold. So, and this is one of the funny examples where you can actually compute exactly the path integral sometimes and just get a number. And sometimes you get, yeah, you get funny numbers. For example, this is a bit, so for example, if you take Trent-Simon's theory, which is here, sorry, there is a prefactor also here, k over 4 pi. If you take the gauge group to be SU2, then you can compute exactly the path integral on a three sphere, and you just get this number. Apparently, the number comes a bit out of nowhere, but it means that you can actually exactly compute these path integrals. What you also saw in class, I think you saw examples of spin foam models. And spin foam models, there are also ways to compute these path integrals. Yeah, and so for example, if you want to explicitly do this for three-dimensional gravity, you can look at the book of Karlip, for example. He has a book on 2+1-dimensional quantum gravity. And in one of the first chapters, he does explicitly this gauge fixing of the constraints of BF theory and computes exactly the path integral and shows that it's an invariant of the topology of the manifold. So what you also saw in class, I think, is that spin foam models, they are also an expression which is actually, in a sense, a partition function, so a path integral, which is defined over a manifold M. And this is defined as the sum over some data. So for example, some irreducible representation of some gauge group. And so it's a sum over this data, and then a product over, I write, for example, delta 0 and some amplitude A0, and then delta D and some amplitude AD. This means that you can take this manifold, you can represent the manifold in terms of a triangulation or a simplicial decomposition, which has, for example, zero-dimensional elements like vertices, one-dimensional elements, two-dimensional elements, maybe d-dimensional elements like tetrahedra or four simplices. And then you assign amplitudes to all these simplices. And then you can form this quantity. And actually, this has the nice property that if this is the quantization of a topological theory, well, again, because the topological theory has no local degrees of freedom, this quantity is independent of the triangulation that you choose. This is why once you compute this thing, you get a quantity, essentially a number, complex number, which only depends on the manifold itself and not on the way in which you choose to discretize the manifold. Yeah, so this, the fact that now we're kind of saying that a topological theory, you can represent sometimes its path integral in terms of this more abstract data. This is now not the data that looks like data of a continuous field theory. And this is something actually very a nice property, because it tells us that when we think about a topological quantum field theory, we don't have necessarily to define this theory in terms of a real continuous field theory, like we wrote before, like BF theory and like Trent-Simon's theories. Because these theories are topological, it means that it doesn't really matter what happens locally in these theories. So you don't have to know the full field theory description. All that is necessary, if you want, is some information, which is this data here and these amplitudes, which capture topological information about the manifold. So this actually means that there are many much more efficient ways of describing topological quantum field theories, which is that we can forget about these continuous actions, transignments, or BF. You can do much more abstract things. Namely, you can define these topological theories in terms of some sums over amplitudes assigned to simplicial decompositions. And you can also go even one step further and just define these topological theories in terms of little drawings on manifolds. So these drawings on manifolds is essentially, again, assigning some amplitudes, some weights, to some geometrical building blocks. So this just to say that PQ FTs can be defined more abstractly, so in terms of these simplicial decompositions, or in terms of some graphical representation. I'm a bit running out of time now, but so now this connects to what I was saying in the beginning. We said that to know the quantum theory, the quantization of these topological field theories, there are two routes that you can follow. The first one is to just take the field theory itself, try to quantize it, but this is in general a complicated thing to do. So one other thing you can do is forget about the rigorous quantization. You can just try to come up with a list of axioms, which are axioms that you would like the path integral for this theory, no matter how it's defined, in terms of some graphical calculus, in terms of this triangulation, or the continuous path integral. If you can think of some axioms that this path integral has to satisfy, then you can list all these axioms and then try to find solutions that exactly satisfy these axioms. And by doing this, you can actually attempt at classifying every possible topological quantum field theory that exists, depending on the dimension that you choose. And this is usually what mathematicians actually do. So physicists defined or discovered these topological field theories by discovering the classical continuous action describing the field theory. But then mathematicians made this much more abstract in terms of axioms. And then they have this much more, you know, mathematical, axiomatic way of describing this, which is why I wrote this funny thing in the beginning that they say that, I don't know, this, you can understand this as some funny mathematical object, which is not the point here. But so in fact, more abstractly, what a topological quantum field theory does is that it actually assigns a Hilbert space H sigma to a D minus one surface sigma. And it assigns vectors, so the path integral over a manifold M, and this vector is in H sigma. So essentially, what a topological quantum field theory always does is that if you take a D minus one dimensional surface, you're actually assigning a Hilbert space to this surface. And whenever you compute the path integral on a manifold whose boundary is a surface sigma, what you will get is a vector in this Hilbert space H sigma. And one can also show generically, just by looking at these more kind of axiomatic formulations of PQFTs, that this Hilbert space H sigma is always of a finite dimension. Okay, and now the last thing I wanted to say is so now what are the applications of this, just to say, yeah. Of course, there are many mathematical applications because mathematicians just try to classify all possible TQFTs that can exist depending on the dimension. But the physical applications, which are maybe more relevant to this class, so the first ones are in quantum gravity. So the just one I wanted to mention is that in loop quantum gravity, the counting of black hole entropy relies a lot on one object, which is the dimension of the Hilbert space of a certain topological quantum field theory. So this is the dimension of the Hilbert space of SU2 Chern-Simons theory on a manifold which is a two-sphere on S2. And I don't know, Hal will talk about black holes, but I don't know, probably he will not talk about this, but.
Okay,
Hal will mention this. So this is one place in quantum gravity where knowledge of these topological quantum field theories is important, and this one is Chern-Simons theory with the gauge group SU2, because this is the Hasch-Tekar connection, which is an SU2 connection, and the manifold is a two-sphere, which is like the horizon of the black hole. Then one other thing is that spin forms in four dimensions, which are supposed to represent quantum gravity, we can write them as a theory which is almost topological. It's this BF theory, which you can represent exactly in terms of a simplicial path integral, a spin form model, but you want to put some constraints on top of this BF theory. And this constraint will make this theory not topological anymore, but will turn this into gravity, so reintroduce local degrees of freedom. And the other, so these are the applications relevant to quantum gravity. And one application relevant to another field is in condensed matter. And in condensed matter, people are interested in these topological theories because they are essentially a low energy field theory description of what people call topologically ordered phases of matter. Or if you want, these are systems of strongly correlated electrons. So this is relevant for topological order. And I think I'm out of time, so thanks.
There's one thing I thought you might want to clarify, which is at one point you were saying that this path integral is a complex number, and at another point you were saying it was a vector. So what's the consistency between these two?
Oh, because this here I meant this would be for a manifold without boundary. Then you just get a number. If it's a manifold with boundary, it's not a number, but it's like something that depends on the boundary value of these fields. But then whenever you plug some boundary value, this returns a number for you.
And a nice thing that you can kind of see is that taking two manifolds, each with boundary, gluing them along the boundary gives you a number. That's like taking a vector product of the two vectors.
Yeah.
A dot product.
Yeah, so this is what I meant by all these axioms, that you can make this very axiomatic. Because if this thing has no local degrees of freedom, it means that you don't have to care about what happens locally. You can just kind of describe what happens if you glue manifolds together, if you glue path integrals, if you chop manifolds, if you do all these operations.
This first application, is it in three or four dimensions, this black hole entropy?
But this is in four dimensions, yeah. It's in four dimensions.
Okay, thanks, Mark. And maybe.
Okay, so hi. I'm a bit continuing where Mark left off. Not with the mathematical definitions of PQFTs, but about how to construct the theory of quantum gravity. And what we typically have is you know, not the theory of quantum gravity, but we have different proposals and models. Of quantum gravity. And what you learned in this course, these models you considered here, they are actually related to PQFTs. In the sense that the kinematics of quantum gravity is shared with the kinematics of PQFTs. And Marx said that basically there are not really physical degrees of freedom, or that they're quite simple. To make them less simple, you allow in these TQFTs so-called defects. So that's where basically these equations of motion of these TQFTs, which makes them to some degree trivial, don't hold anymore. And actually the reason why these TQFTs are very nice and lead to a very nice notion of quantum geometry. Is that these defects, one part of the physical definition is that they don't interact with each other. So that also means we can define the entire theory to be diffeomorphism invariant, at least a diffeomorphism invariant in a DQFT sense, because you can write the theory so such it does not depend on kind of the distance between two defects, for instance. And that's very different from a standard quantum field theory, which we always have on a quantum on a background, and where the two-point correlation function, basically everything there is in the distance function. You know, it goes with one over the distance. So here the use of this TQFTs to describe quantum geometry, that's completely motivated by diffeomorphism symmetry. And in fact, we don't know any other method to construct a diffeomorphism invariant theory, field theory, than using basically the ideas of TQFTs. So even loop quantum gravity, that wasn't really originally spelled out this way, but if you then analyze it from a backward point of view, that's basically what LQG has been doing is what basically a bit later was discussed. Are TQFTs with defects. And nowadays we basically can also say, because of this classification of TQFTs, you know, what would be, say, the best TQFTs which are most useful for building kind of quantum geometry representation. And so at this level, things are working very fine. The main problem, I would say, is basically dynamics. And also, Mark mentioned these spinform models. It's certainly one possibility. But even if you take any other kind of model, the main problem in the dynamics then is basically to ensure full diffeomorphism invariance. And the thing which was standing here somewhere behind was a spinform was a model with a discretization which Mark wrote for TQFT, and he mentioned that it's invariant under triangulation, for instance, which is very important because the triangulation is just some auxiliary structure, and you want to make sense out of your result, and if it does depend a lot on your triangulation, you don't really know what it means. You can take it as a regulator. But if you do have a four-dimensional gravity, it's not anymore topological, and we can write out these spinform models. But then in these cases, if you start with these local formulations, these models are not fully diffeomorphism invariant anymore. And in particular, they depend on this triangulation. So the triangulation in these cases are kind of a regulator. And the problem is to remove this regulator and then to hope that you recover diffeomorphism invariance. And this is all basically, you could see us constructing actually a completely new kind of quantum field theory. No, it's basically the question, is it a local quantum field theory, which is diffeomorphism invariant? But is non-topological, because the only diffeomorphism invariant quantum field series we know are actually the topological ones. So it's non-topological, or sometimes it's also called, you know, interacting, really. So it's also not a free field theory. And that's a main challenge. And the challenge about this is that there is actually no other quantum field theory which we know which has this property apart from gravity. One aspect of that, as I already mentioned a bit, is this question of locality. So writing the spinform model, for instance, we build things up locally by gluing these building blocks. In some sense, that's a very local model. As I mentioned, that can be only an approximation. So if you ask, however, for the fundamental definition of the model, we know that such a structure is not consistent with being diffeomorphism invariant and with being non-topological. So we know that it works for topological series. And one reason why it works for topological series is indeed that the result is triangulation independent. For non-topological series, we even need to rethink how we formulate things. If you use a discretization, the problem is, you could say, it's a triangulation invariant. Even in the continuum, the problem which again we have there is, you could say, it's observables. Which again have to be very non-local and very different from standard quantum field theory. In standard quantum field theory, we do use fields evaluated at some point x. This notion does become completely useless in quantum gravity. These are not observables. And then also in quantum field theory, as you might know, basically, you can build everything in principle if you're a mathematician. Everything about quantum field theory is encoded in correlation functions, or the so-called Weidman function. And these are, again, correlation things. They do depend crucially on the distance here. You do have always this notion of points, of distances between the points, and you can even build up, if you are on Minkowski space, you heavily use the notion of Poincaré symmetry. So even if you do this one step away from that, from going from flat spacetime to curved spacetime, there are much more ambiguities you do add in this case. And there's still ongoing research how to really understand quantum field CSP theory on curved spacetime. So here the first question is, what kind of observers would you use in quantum gravity? And unfortunately, we don't really know too many observables. You could think of kind of relational constructions, but it's hard to write these relational observables out explicitly. And they would, this relational construction would be always, what is the value of a field at a point where four other fields have certain other values? But if you think of how much can you localize any point in space-time by using other quantum field theories, it's really hard to imagine that you can do that very well. So there's already some notion of non-locality in it. And this also relates to these models, to these spinform models, and how to formulate them and how to formulate the so-called, say, renormalization of these spinform models. And renormalization means the main problem, and if you even have these spin four models or any model, is to consider the continuum limit and also have a formulation in which you can take this continuum limit. And the key tool is renormalization. Now, again, this is a slightly different kind of renormalization than in standard quantum field theory, because in standard quantum field theory, renormalization crucially depends on a notion of scale, which we don't have here. So we need to invent, again, new formulations for that. And indeed, I kind of did reformulate how to actually express renormalization in this context. And one important aspect seems to be something which you could call quasi local holography. And what also Mark mentioned, boundaries. So instead of formulating locally something with small building blocks, the problem actually in quantum gravity is that there's not really a small building block, because small is already a variable in quantum gravity. Small is part of the metric, and the metric is a variable, and so it's actually part of your boundary data. So what we do have to find is basically amplitudes associated to arbitrary boundaries. And these boundaries, they carry boundary data. But we still need to find the amplitudes for these arbitrary, basically for arbitrary boundary data. And the point is to be able to compute them consistently and to have an approximation scheme for these quantities, which is similarly useful. I mean, that would be a dream, like all the approximation schemes we have in quantum field theory. Because in the end, in standard quantum field theory, usually we cannot make exact calculations. We cannot solve them completely. Mostly we do in perturbative quantum field theory. But this is because in perturbative quantum field theory, we really have something which we can approximate in it, which is a small coupling or some distances. That's quite different than quantum gravity. So the entire formulation of renormalization has to rely on some kind of approximation parameter. And in fact, this approximation parameter is given in some sense on the boundary and by the boundary data, by the kind of boundary data. And this is how coarse or how fine these boundaries are. And given that you mostly operate with boundaries, things which we explored recently and we are going to explore more is the question of how much so-called holographic dualities can help in understanding properties of quantum gravity. And that's also a very interesting question, because it's where contact can be made or not. That's a bit of an open question, of course, to standard EDS CFT tools or to holographic renormalization. So that opens basically lots of connections to string theory or perturbative approaches to quantum field theory. Okay, so any questions? Not from this guy?
And what this perturbation parameter would be that we use?
So that's a good question. Here already in TQFTs and these defects, you have a structure which is that you can basically allow only for a certain amount of defects. And you might have seen that already, I guess, because you had spin networks. And the spin networks depend on a graph. Now these graphs can be very fine or very coarse. So in these cases, the approximation parameter, you could say, is basically the fineness of the graph. This is still a bit abstract. And in the end, what you actually want to have is even a more physical notion of approximation parameter. And In principle, this has to be determined by the dynamics, but roughly intuitively, what we want to have is that coarse graphs really describe homogeneous states. And the approximation parameter would be basically the amount of inhomogeneity you add in your boundary data. But what exactly is a homogeneous state is another question. And this depends on basically the dynamics you have in your theory. So it's in fact, PQFDs are also very special in a different way, which is if you think about the vacuum and quantum field theory and the vacuum and PQFDs. The vacuum and quantum field theory is kind of a Gaussian state. In some sense, it's very homogeneous. In another sense, is however not, if you're not conformal, it's not really invariant under scale changes. And it's a Gaussian state between, which has some spread, that is between two extreme cases. And these extreme cases you can understand as delta function. In the case of a TQFD, usually the vacuum is a delta function. In the examples Mark has written, the vacuum is a delta function on the curvature. But you can also write a delta function on the conjugated variable, which is this electrical field, and guess you rather were introduced to this kind of vacuum in LPG. And then the perturbation parameter would be the defects, the number of defects on top of this delta function.
I mean, maybe it's a bit naive, but if observables are local, how do you reconcile that with observers being very local? So we make a local measurement or something like this.
Yeah, so that's a good question. So there's a mathematical or theory definition of observables, and the most easiest observables you can think of, which might be diffeomorphism invariant, are like very global things, like the volume of the universe, which maybe you can imagine is a bit hard to measure. On the other hand, something like the Hubble radius you can measure. And one way out would be these relational observables. The problem is relational observables is where you use some kind of physical kind of clocks and physical rods, because you say it's exactly at the time where some other field takes some value. And the problem is how much can you actually determine these values? And are you sure that your clock goes always forward? And there's only one place where this takes a certain value. And so these are all questions which are only a tiny bit explored. And indeed, if you think about how important these questions were for even the invention of quantum mechanics, with this uncertainty principle, in fact, if you really explore these kind of questions, there's kind of other additional uncertainty principles which one can at least heuristically motivate. Still, there's much more work to be done in understanding these properties. But in fact, it's one of the hard questions with quantum gravity to kind of reconcile how local can an observable be. And many people believe it's at least not the same kind of locality we have in quantum field theory. And you can derive some kind of bounds heuristically and get some new kinds of uncertainty relations from that.
Thanks, Bianca.
I think you all have heard my name before, but I'm Hal. I knew I was going last, and I knew I would have a shorter time. So I am going to try and keep it very brief, but it's not because there isn't lots more to say. And my office is just past Maite's office. It's just at the end of that hall. So please feel free to come by and chat with me about these things anytime. I wanted to kind of take a step back from the details of the class, from the details of quantum gravity, and sort of ask again, why do we care about quantizing gravity? What's the interesting thing here? Why is this something that you might want to think about into the future? And I think Mark and Bianca have done a good job of motivating this. The main point is that really interesting puzzles come out of thinking about quantum gravity. And that's why I think a lot of us spend a lot of time thinking about it and why we keep going back to it. It's a really rich source of puzzles, of odd things. Today I want to tell you about a very idiosyncratic puzzle. It's one I hope you've never heard before, and one that I'm interested in right now, but you've probably never seen it. And then to try and combat the fact that that's so weird and atypical in my own puzzle, I wanted to go to the most standard puzzle in all of quantum gravity, which is the puzzle of what is black hole entropy. So that's the plan. So as you know, space-time is dynamical. And it witnesses its own breakdown. I think you kind of get used to this after you've seen it a few times, but it's amazing. So one way to kind of characterize this is by the Penrose diagram. So say for the Penrose diagram of a Schwarzschild black hole, it looks something like this. And we think of this as a classical space-time. So this is something like the room we sit in. There's a black hole at the center of our galaxy, and so this point is really like that. And this is a causal diagram. So we have roughly T going up and R going to the right. But we know that as you go into the black hole, curvatures and other things blow up at this singularity, and there's some kind of breakdown of the classical theory. So you've heard this a ton, and I will not belabor this point further. It predicts its own breakdown. But what does it mean if we take quantum gravity seriously? So if space-time is quantum, then you can form superpositions. And in particular, you can form superpositions of black holes. So something like a Schwarzschild black hole, which has no angular momentum, can also be thought of as a superposition of black holes with angular momentum. So very schematically, if this is a Schwarzschild black hole with no rotation, we can think of this as being made up of a bunch of black holes, a superposition of a bunch of black holes with different angular momenta that basically add up to zero. But this is extremely puzzling if you think about this a little more. The causal picture of a rotating black hole looks like the following. So this diagram can be continued as many times as you want. Again, this would be like a typical point in this room outside of the rotating black hole in the center of our galaxy. The black hole event horizon, if it was eternal, would be here. And you probably have seen that this black hole also has internal horizons. And the singularities are a completely different structure. So whereas the singularity was space-like here, and any observer that entered into the black hole eventually encounters the singularity, in this case, it's time-like. And any observer that enters the black hole, well, could, in principle, use their thrusters enough to just continue on into the continuation of the space time. So the puzzle I want to pose to you then is the average of time-like singularities really space-like? If I can really think of a Schwarzschild black hole as a superposition over rotating black holes, can I really think of that causal diagram as a superposition of these causal diagrams? If so, what the heck? How do you make sense of that correspondence? If not, why not? What's the issue? What breaks down? So this is the kind of puzzle I think is really an interesting outcome of quantum gravity and thinking about quantum gravity. Okay. 5 minutes. So I'll spend 2 more minutes and then I'll give you time to ask any questions you want. So the totally most celebrated result in quantum gravity probably is the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And it's following, it's equal to the area of the black hole horizon divided by 4 times the Planck length squared. It shows that it's an entropy. It's dimensionless when we set k equals 1. Or writing it out more explicitly, it's the horizon area over 4 h bar g, where I've set c equal to 1. So just on dimensional grounds, I think there's a really interesting thing to notice about this. It relates entropy or thermodynamics to geometry, to quantum mechanics, to gravity, to relativity. And k equals 1, we usually say that the Boltzmann constant is trivial. I think that's not true. The Boltzmann constant is telling you that you have some statistical thing to count. So it also contains statistical mechanics. So this formula has every piece of physics that we think about wrapped up in it. And the puzzle here is a very straightforward puzzle, which is that quantum mechanics makes entropies actually make much more sense. It's an issue of counting microstates, right? In the classical theory, there are infinite microstates. So there's every point in the phase space, given, say, an energy shell. But quantum mechanics takes those and says, well, you can only resolve those up to a Planck area. And so it actually makes sense to count microstates. And so we might be able to make sense of this formula in quantum gravity if we could count the microstates that give this entropy. But every approach to quantum gravity agrees on this formula and disagrees on what those microstates are. So in loop quantum gravity, which if I'd had a few more minutes, I would have told you more about what this looks like in loop quantum gravity. In loop quantum gravity, there are actually 2 ways of looking at this, one that Mark mentioned, which is as tessellations of the horizon area. So all the different ways of cutting the horizon up into pieces that are still consistent with that area. That's one way of looking at it. On the other hand, you can think of it in terms of entropy and as related to thermodynamic entanglement entropy across the horizon. And I think there's a really interesting and curious thing in loop quantum gravity, which is a formula that I think Maite's mentioned in class, which is the simplicity constraint, which relates the generator of boosts to the generator of areas, which is an angular momentum in loop quantum gravity. So these 2 different pictures of an RT plane picture of entanglement and a theta phi picture of entanglement are intriguingly kind of correlated with each other in loop quantum gravity. So I'll stop there. I understand that I said lots in a little time, but I'm happy to chat anytime.
Say a little bit why it's a timeline for the rotating black hole for the diagram.
So the why is a little tricky for me to say because it's just it's a mathematical result okay. that it's time-like. But let me try and indicate that there might be something interesting going on. The Kerr metric has a parameter in it, which people often call delta. This parameter is r squared minus r times rs minus d squared. Yes, I think that's right. And this parameter ends up defining where the horizons are. So if you set this equal to 0, you find the event horizon and the inner horizon. So you can see it's a quadratic equation. It has two roots. RS is the Schwarzschild radius. This is 2gm over c squared. A is the Kerr parameter. It's essentially the angular momentum over the mass of the black hole. You solve this condition, and you get this horizon, which is a lot like the horizon you're used to from Schwarzschild. But you also get a second horizon. And you find that that second horizon is another null surface. It's this inner horizon. Sometimes it's called R minus. So already you can see, just because of the presence of these two horizons, which are both null, that there's no way for a singularity to occur that's space-like between these two horizons, as long as the curvature doesn't diverge while you're approaching these horizons. So it kind of has to be time-like after you cross this null surface. So that's an indication. Then it's a calculation just to check that that's true, what I'm saying, that indeed the curvature is in the mathematical metric is finite until you get it. Yeah.
You talk about superpositions here and stuff, but like, if you do quantum stuff, like if you do any measurement, then it immediately like goes down to like it collapses into one thing. So saying that like something is a superposition, like if we do any measurement in the universe, which we assume like quantum decoherence exists, so we do one measurement and we'll get back to a rotating black hole.
So of course I agree, and so I think this is what's fun to think about here. We tend, for whatever reasons, we tend to have deep classical intuitions about space-time, right? And so it's really, you say, oh, quantum gravity, and you think you know what you're talking about, but then you really put together quantum mechanics and space-time, and you have to think about superpositions of space-time. And that's a very, I have the same classical intuition as you. Wait, if there's any measurement, then of course it's immediately going to be one of these. And I don't have to worry about the superposition. That's only true as long as quantum gravity is negligible. So it's only true as long as you're in low curvature regimes. As we approach the Schwarzschild singularity, so I don't even have to ask rotating, not rotating, then on some space-like surface here, the curvature becomes Planckian, becomes extremely large, and it's no longer a valid approximation to continue thinking about this as a classical space-time diagram beyond that point. It's how we think quantum gravity resolves the singularity, that there's some breakdown in our classical intuition before we get.
Can you do a measurement outside of the black hole that will tell you its rotation?
Yes. So this is what they do nowadays. So for example, gravity wave measurements will tell you the spin of the black hole. It's a complicated inversion, but by looking at how the gravity waves come off of a merger, they're able to constrain the spin after the fact. So this is a really interesting thing that's happening right now, that we're able to really characterize that well. So right now they've done, what, 5 black hole mergers they've measured. And so we don't have population statistics. We don't know what's the average spin of a black hole. But we're about to enter that period. As soon as they can do 10 a year, we're going to build up more and more.
Or even, I think, with the Event Horizon Telescope, the picture that you would get from a rotating or a non-rotating black hole is really different. So even visually, you can see that it's...
But then, if you can measure that, you won't be able to make it superposition. That's the problem.
So good. So you, in another way of asking your question is, what black holes do I imagine that this puzzle that I posed to you applies to? So a population of black holes that I could imagine it applying to is a primordial black hole. So rather than thinking of 2 black holes that merged and formed another black hole, or 2 neutron stars that merged and formed a black hole, if I imagine that sometime late in the inflationary process there were large fluctuations in the density, then you might form a black hole that is on average Schwarzschild, but could be thought of as a superposition. So that would be another regime where I'm in a high curvature region that has this kind of superposition relevance. Whether primordial black holes exist is an open question. Thank you.
Thanks. Hi again. I'm the speaker of the day, so I have some cookies for all of you guys. Thanks for speaking today, but the students are allowed to have some cookies too.